What's Next from American Security Project. I'm Maggie Feldman-Pilch. Today I'm joined by Jason Bruder. Jason Bruder has formerly done many things, a former Foreign Service officer, a staffer on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, very recently Chief of Staff to Ambassador David Thorne, a special senior advisor to the Secretary of State, John Kerry, and is now the George F. Kennan Fellow at the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center. I got the whole title right, Jason?
Maggie, you do me more justice than I deserve. At least I have a present. I'm not entirely all former.
There you go. That's all that matters. But Jason, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So, Jason, we're going to talk about something we've never talked about before on What's Next, which should be exciting. And that is the relationship between and role of Congress in foreign policy.
It's an often overlooked topic, unfortunately.
And you've said to me in the past that, in fact, Congress does have a role in foreign policy. Is that true?
You know, it's funny. People in Washington, and I'm sure you've heard this as many times as I have, when they talk about the foreign policy process, they talk about the State Department, talk about the NSC, certainly, the White House. They talk about the Pentagon. Very rarely does Congress come into the equation, and that's, I think, an oversight, both on constitutional grounds, because in the Constitution, it's very clear that the President of the United States and Congress share responsibility for foreign policy, but more importantly, in practice, and that's why I wanted to talk about this today.
So, as someone who's relatively new to D.C., you know, I was not a former Foreign Service officer. My memory includes not a lot of positive, you know, in terms of Congress and foreign policy. But you've spent time in Congress. And so I wonder, you know, are there things that make experiences that you've had that made you say, yeah, Congress does have a role to play here?
Okay, well, that's a good question. About 17 years ago, my first job in Washington, my first serious job, was carrying binders and basically being support staff for the senior level guy who would go up to brief staff on the House Foreign Affairs, Senate Foreign Relations, and the appropriators. This is in the late 90s or 1998, when the Cold War had ended. We didn't really have a clear idea what was coming. The expense of trying to step in and peacekeep in all of the ethnic conflicts that had broken out around the world was proving enormous. The political pressure to act in places like Bosnia was enormous. And yet there was an unwillingness in the Congress to support U.S. troops going into these places. And there was a reluctance to support U.N. peacekeepers, who I think there were some tens of thousands at the time. So Jesse Helms, who was a major, major force in this town for 30 years, was elected to the Senate in 1973, served until about 2003, I believe. He was a very conservative senator from North Carolina. He was chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee from 1995 until 2003. He was known nationally at the time for being like a real traditional conservative. He was very hostile to gay and lesbian rights, was known for racial overtones in his reelection campaigns, and had the sobriquet Senator No for his tendency to block things. And as chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, and as a very active chairman, I might add, he had many opportunities. I have some respect for him, in spite of disagreeing with him on just about everything. Because when I was a young man, we were going up there to brief him and his staff. I realized how powerful he was. You know, he was a force. He got the Clinton administration to basically change policy on many things. Hmm. I remember distinctly going in into a conference room that I think I later turned out to be my office about 10 years later, over in the Senate office buildings. And it was a couple of senior State Department officials and me. Helms was known for blocking literally dozens of ambassadorial nominees during his career. And I think any senior level State Department official who went into his domain did so very carefully. We went into the conference room, and in the corner there was a styrofoam tombstone, like the kind that people put on their lawns in suburban Virginia on Halloween.
Yeah.
And on the tombstone were the names of three federal agencies. The first one, I think, was USIA, the old U.S. Information Service. Uh-huh. Another one was ACTA, which was the Disarmament Negotiation Agency. And the third was USAID. Now, the first two had lines through them because just that year or the year before, Helms had successfully gotten the Clinton administration to basically fold both of those into the State Department. Hmm. But the rumor was that he'd really wanted to get USAID, which is, of course, still an independent agency today.
Right.
But it was a close-run thing. And, you know, looking at that tombstone, I think I probably had the same reaction that you would have if you went into the tent of a great chieftain and you saw a pile of skulls. Yes. You know, you'd think, you know, boy, this guy has got some power.
Yeah.
And he did. You know, while he was there, he did a number of things. He blocked a lot of things. He passed a major sanctions bill, the Helms-Burton bill in 1996, which we can talk about later. But so that was my first run-in with the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And a few short years later, I was working there.
So what is the role, you know, of Congress and foreign policy? Maybe what's the role of the Senate and what's the role of the House kind of overall?
Well, you're right to distinguish between the two. Constitutionally, the Senate has more prerogatives on foreign policy than the House does. That doesn't mean that the House is irrelevant. They're not at all. And at some points, they've been more involved and maybe more effective than the Senate at getting their will. But basically, you know, there are two answers to this question. There's the constitutional one. And, you know, in Article 1, the longest article in the Constitution, I think, the responsibilities of the Senate and the House are laid out. They have the ability to raise and equip the Army and Navy. The Senate has the ability to, the special ability to vote on treaties, passing them by a two-thirds majority. The Senate also has the ability to vote on the president's nominees for ambassadorships around the world and senior positions. So, you know, there are also revenue powers, which were more important in the 19th century than maybe now. But so basically, you know, there's a lot there. But from the get-go, it was obvious that the president and the Secretary of State would have to be responsible for the day-to-day implementation of foreign policy, making the decisions and implementing them through their various officials. But, you know, in the 19th century, Congress was very powerful vis-a-vis the president. And, you know, Congress has the ability to declare war. And in the 19th century, they did that in 1812 and 1898, arguably largely at the behest of Congress. The president was driven into asking for those declarations. And so, you know, in the 19th century, the role was relatively obvious. I know it was indisputable. Even Woodrow Wilson, who later became president, you know, wrote in a book when he was a political scientist at Princeton that you know, Congress was the dominant institution in American government, except perhaps in the area of foreign policy. Hmm. So you have a history of Congress being very important, but not necessarily in foreign policy. But at the same time, it has these responsibilities. And what that's meant in the modern world requires some explanation. I guess the easiest way to do that is to sort of talk about the various ways in which both the House and the Senate weigh in on foreign policy. So the obvious one to start with, I guess, is treaties. You know, just like I said before, the Constitution gives the Senate the right to approve treaties. And it's largely because of that fact and because of the fact that it requires a two-thirds majority that it's so little done.
Right.
Because, let's frankly, I mean, you know, the Senate killed a lot of treaties in the 19th century.
They've killed a lot of treaties more recently than that. There's a comprehensive test ban treaty just sitting around.
That's absolutely right. It's a pity that that wasn't passed in 1999.
UNCLOS, right?
Yep, yeah, that's right. I'd say the CTBT, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, that was one of the big defeats in the Senate in the 20th century. That and maybe the League of Nations in 1920. But you know, basically, there are a couple of things that they do with treaties. If the administration doesn't think they have the votes, they sit on them.
Right.
And that's been the fate of the Law of the Sea Treaty.
Absolutely.
Which I think was negotiated by the UN back in the 1980s and is you know, periodically revived but never really introduced.
One day.
In spite of the fact that, you know, the Navy, the industry have all testified.
There, I can't think of a single person with relevant experience who is opposed to UNCLOS. Now, I'm sure there's someone who will come out of the word work now that I've said that out loud, but, you know, I think it's well known that ASP and our board members, our consensus members, have expressed enthusiastic support for UNCLOS.
I would love to see it passed. When I was on the committee, both Chairman Biden and Chairman Kerry both looked into it. But, you know, for obvious reasons, there have been a few senators, actually from inland states, strangely enough, who have opposed it on sovereignty grounds.
Well, must be nice not to have an ocean nearby, I guess, but...
and it's sad but true, but, by opposing things, sometimes the Senate has lost the very... power that it or authority that it was looking to exercise. The same thing is true of war powers. You know, treaties and war powers are two of the classic things that the Senate is responsible for in foreign policy. But the United States has only declared war on 5 occasions, officially, I mean formally.
Really?
Only 5 occasions.
What are those 5? That's more complicated.
The War of 1812.
Uh-huh.
The Spanish, the Mexican War.
Uh-huh.
We didn't declare war on ourselves in the Civil War.
Fair, that makes sense.
There was the Spanish-American War in 1898,
mm-hmm.
World War I, and World War II. But since then, we've relied upon other vehicles. I mean, you'll recall that Johnson got authority to act in Vietnam from the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution.
Right.
We had a vote in the Senate before the Gulf War in 1991 and in 2003 before the invasion of Iraq. But... these were not declarations of war.
Right, they're regarding specific action.
Exactly, and not a classic vote. Back in the 70s, after the Vietnam situation, some of the senators passed a resolution, the War Powers Resolution, which is still on the books,
right?
But is never really activated. As you know, we've used our military dozens and dozens of times since 1973 when this resolution was passed. But, you know, it hasn't been activated. And it really doesn't ask all of that much of the administration.
Mm.
It basically says you have to tell the Congress within 48 hours that you're using your military forces, our military forces.
Hmm.
And then if the military action lasts longer than 60 days, the Congress has to act. There has to be some sort
of
legislative
decision.
You're right. There has to be some sort of decision. So, but even that bar has been too much to cross. So regrettably, we don't really have a formal process at this point.
So you mentioned just a few minutes ago that in acting or voting down specific treaties, the Senate maybe has given up the power it was looking for, that it was hoping to gain. D- Do you think that that's kind of something you can characterize overall? Congress has shot itself in the foot in terms of having a proactive rather than a reactive role to foreign policy, you know, that maybe their own behavior has gotten in their way of being truly involved in foreign policy as the founders intended them to be?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that sometimes out of necessity they have to be reactive because as we were saying, the president has the day-to-day management of things. But there are good examples of members of Congress, individuals and committees, who have stepped up and actually led on foreign policy. A great example of this, and also a Republican like Senator Helms, Senator Richard Lugar, who was chairman
recipient of the ASP Lugar Award.
Well, and I didn't know that.
No, yes.
It was richly deserved. I have nothing but admiration for Senator Lugar. You know, he's an outstanding American and a great representative. And, you know, even though I wasn't in the same party, I was very sorry to see him leave the Senate. But, you know, Lugar and then-Senator Nunn, Democratic Senator from Georgia, were responsible in 1991 for introducing legislation, which is another way to affect foreign policy, by establishing programs that implement foreign policy. And they established the Cooperative Threat Reduction Program, which is mainly occupied with eliminating and disposing of weapons of mass destruction material. It emerged from a visit that Nunn paid to Moscow in 1991, just after the coup against Gorbachev.
Yeah.
And in talking to Gorbachev, he realized that it may have been true that Gorbachev didn't have full control over the nuclear arsenal at some point during that coup attempt. And he realized that we really did need better controls I mean all of us, that the Russians and ourselves need in that. So this program is terrific, and they helped the Russians, who were sort of, you know, dealing with unbelievable difficulties in the early 90s, basically tie down a lot of their nuclear material so that they didn't fall in the hands of terrorists. So this is something that the administration at the time wasn't wildly enthusiastic about. It's something that Senator Lugar, because he stayed in the Senate, Senator Nunn, I think, retired about 10 years later, but Senator Lugar stayed until 2012, I believe. And during that time, he was there to protect, tweak, improve the program.
Right.
You know, he remained invested in it in an important way, and it really did fulfill a valuable mission and goes on doing so over at the work at the Defense Threat Reduction Agency.
So one of kind of the key tenets that ASP was founded on, right, is this idea, you know, as we're a nonpartisan organization, this idea that politics stop at the water's edge, that when it comes to foreign policy and national security, there is no room for partisanship. And sometimes, more often than not these days, it seems that issues of national security, of foreign policy, things that really matter in a grand scale, get politicized. This can be something from TPP to action in Syria to our relationship with Russia. And is that really I think it's an easy argument that it's not in the best interest of the United States to politicize the issues, but do you think it's in the best interest of Congress I don't want to say avoid cooperation, because I think that's maybe assigning malice where it is not intentional, but that it allows them to be involved even if they're not on the appropriate committee, right? I'm thinking about, you know, select committees that have been pulled together to require testimony and investigate X, Y, and Z when it didn't even really make sense to do so.
Yeah, it's an interesting point you've made about politics stopping at the water's edge. That's the impression that people have about the way Congress traditionally worked. I think that was true for maybe about 20 years after World War II.
Oh, so it hasn't been that way for a while, huh?
Well, I mean, you know...
no, you could totally be right.
Just as, you know, the influence of Congress on foreign policy waxes and wanes.
Right.
Somebody once argued that Congress is at its most influential on foreign policy when we're at peace, when the United States is in a period of relative peace.
Yeah.
So, the period from 1919 until 1941, Congress was very powerful. You know, FDR didn't have a free hand. They passed the Neutrality Acts. They really constrained his ability to assist the Brits and get involved in doing something to stop Hitler early on. Maybe because there was some regret that they'd been a little too restrained in the interwar period. After World War II, they were very eager to work with some of the congressional leaders, I should say, were very eager to work with the president. And perhaps FDR and Truman were very clever in the way that they worked with the Congress. But even then, at the height of congressional deference to the administration's wishes, when the administration was constructing this vast infrastructure that we had to fight the Cold War, even then, you had the McCarthy period when he was going after administration officials. There probably was never a perfect period, but your point about the oppositional nature of, almost reflexively oppositional nature of the current Congress is really is a point well taken. And, you know, for somebody like me who really cares about the institution, you know, the saddest thing is that the current approach of the Republicans in the Senate and the House is that their tactics are eroding the power of the institution.
Right.
You know, Obama was put in position. I mean, Obama, somebody whose entire appearance on the national stage had to do with emphasizing bipartisanship. I mean, that's what he spoke about in 2004 when he first attracted attention. Of course, that's not how the narrative of his presidency worked out. But, you know, by forcing him to act through administrative orders or not accomplish anything or govern the country, I think they've made some terrible mistakes. Somebody like Senator Lugar was always willing to find a Democrat to work on things that he felt were critical to the national interest. And there are lots of ways to do that. But it takes that willingness to cooperate.
So cooperation doesn't just come from Congress, right? You know, you mentioned before we started recording that different secretaries of state, different secretaries of defense as well, have different styles. Some known as kind of bold, brash leaders, others quiet, leading by example. Sure, there's those archetypes, but there's also kind of an operational and tactical difference between each secretary of state. And do you think there are things that a secretary of state or secretary of defense can do within their own organization to better foster not just cooperation with Congress, but Congress's role in foreign policy?
Well, you know, I, having been a career diplomat, I can honestly say that career diplomats, generally feel that they know more about the issues than anybody else. And it's probably fair to say
I'd
that
make
there's
a terrible career diplomat, though.
I don't know about that. But they generally feel that they know their issues, and it's fair to say that in a bureaucratic way they sometimes resent the interference of the Congress. But the Congress does have certain advantages in the shaping of foreign policy, and I think that wise State Department officials realize that. I mean, for one thing, Congress is much closer to the public.
Right.
You know, and they tap into a lot of academic expertise, and they listen to expatriate communities here in the United States. So they're constantly getting good ideas, constantly getting bad ideas, too.
That, too, yes.
They do have that advantage. So sometimes it's worth listening to them. But the great disadvantage that they have is that because they're not managing the day-to-day affairs of our country's interests abroad, they don't have information. And it's frequently, you know, if you watch C-SPAN, and I don't know how many people watch
it's
hearings.
It's always on in this office, don't worry.
I think that's terrific. But if you watch hearings on C-SPAN, you'll see that, you know, very often a complaint is, you haven't responded to my staff's question. We expect you to come up here and testify on that point, too. They're always trying to get information. I mean, that's the whole point of a hearing.
Right.
That's the whole point of oversight, trying to make sure that the executive agencies are doing a good job. And if Congress is doing a good job, they're doing good oversight. So it's a two-way process. And if you're asking me what I think the next, what's next, I'd say this. The new president will have to make a decision, or the new secretary, how open they want to be with Congress, how much consultation they're going to engage in. If they don't engage in consultation, it's almost certainly true that Congress will insist on consultation.
Right. Will it be consultation at that point, or be a bit more adversarial?
Well, obviously the latter. But, you know,
right.
The thing, too, is that you can't guarantee that they're not going to be adversarial from the get-go.
Right.
So the new president and the new secretary will have to weigh their options and will have to make determinations based on what the congressional leadership seems likely to do. And at this point, it's hard to say. You know, we have a general idea over who will be the leadership. Of course, Harry Reid retiring.
Right.
But they won't formally organize the committees until February.
It's going to be a long few months between the election and February. You know, you hope that, I don't want to say that we are still functioning, because who knows if we're truly functioning, you know, on all cylinders now, right? But do you think that given how divisive things have become, that with an election and a new administration and new members of Congress, new senators, new staff, lots of new, maybe not so new totally, but lots of new generally, there's a chance for a clean slate? Or are we kind of on this path with Congress and how it feels about itself in terms of foreign policy?
Well, I think hope springs eternal.
Right. And at least for me it does.
you have to be optimistic unless you want to give up on our system. I took a look at a Gallup poll before I came over, and the latest numbers on congressional job approval was 18%.
That's very low.
That's pretty low, yeah. And when you consider that it hasn't cracked 25% since 2009, that's a lot of room for growth.
The only way next is up.
Yeah, one would hope. And the thing is, there's been a lot of turnover in the last few years. A lot of senior senators left. When senior senators go, very often senior staff go. Both, you know, simply because they got used to working for who they were working for, and also because there are other things they can do to make money. But I would hope that more stay, and that you have more continuity and more experience, both on the staff side, and that the senators who are elected or reelected or newly elected invest the time in really getting to know the issues. Now, it tends to be, senators, because they can block appointments. I mean, the Senate also has this power to approve the president's nominees for the senior positions at the State Department.
It's an enormous amount of power that has enormous implications for national security, let alone, you know, political anything.
Sure, and all of our ambassadors.
Right.
Now, in last year, in 2015, in the summer of 2015, Senator Cruz from Texas put a blanket ban on State Department nominees. For 6 months, this one senator used his senatorial privilege to block all of the nominees for all of the embassies that collected. He did let most of them go in that following February, but that's a six-month period where
we have no one on the ground. And is something ASP has talked about at least as long as I've been here, so certainly before that too, you know, Foreign Service officers, career Foreign Service officers deserve the same level of respect and expediency as we provide our combatant commanders. when they go through nominations. You know, we can't avoid, we need our ambassadors.
I think you're absolutely right. You know, having been a career diplomat, when you, when you're out there, we have very capable people in the embassies, but there's a tendency not to want to take big decisions.
Right.
Until the new ambassador gets there, particularly when you know who it is and they're sitting in Washington.
Right.
Checking their emails, you know, but not really in a position to do anything. So, you know, in this piece I wrote for the Politico recently, I advocated that one thing that the Congress could do, a responsible move, would be to avoid holding ambassadors for any of the countries that touch on the current deadlock with Russia. It only creates opportunities that the Russians could exploit.
Well, Jason, I think this brings us to a good point for our final question, right, which is what's next? And I guess I'll pose it to you this way, which is, you think if Congress kind of continues down this road, whatever this road is, what do you think that means for U.S. foreign policy? And if we are able to turn over a new leaf, what do you think we can expect to see?
It's unrealistic to expect to take politics out of Congress. It's an oxymoron. I mean, and we shouldn't want to,
right?
Because Congress is there to represent, you know, communities, interest groups, both organized by citizens and representing industries and businesses. So Congress provides a valuable function domestically and in foreign policy in that regard. Now, where I would hope that there is some improvement in the near future would be on this willingness to invest the time in developing the relationships abroad. I mean, members of Congress don't have a lot of time, so it really is an investment. But developing relationships abroad through the transatlantic membership...
Partnership
dialogue, the Congress Bundestag dialogue. There are a bunch of these with different democracies. Where members of Congress can talk to their colleagues in foreign governments and really get different perspectives that are very valuable. Congressional travel is very important. I'm a taxpayer. Sometimes the public hate the things they hear about junkets and that kind of thing, but
I'd rather they know the place on the map than didn't.
Exactly. I mean, I'll tell you that I went to plenty of places that nobody would go on a junket to. When I was a staffer. But their staffs and they themselves, the members, the more they get out, the better. Because it really does make a difference. And you want an informed Congress making decisions. You know, another thing that they could do is take oversight seriously. Take it really seriously. It's not sexy. But, you know, doing the hearings, really digging in. And not just, I'm afraid that oversight has become confused with these sort of politically driven
with
exercises.
Theatrics.
Right, which are, you know, are there to score points to some degree, and I'm afraid it's becoming more and more obvious. But when it's run well, when they're really asking tough questions, and when they're trying to, over a long period of time, get to the heart of a matter, these hearings and the other related exercises are important. I'll give you one or two examples. President Truman. Everybody knows Harry Truman, right? Harry Truman was a senator in the early 40s. He was a senator on an important committee investigating expenditures on the buildup for World War II. And there was a lot of waste, fraud, and abuse because, you know, we were mobilizing very quickly.
Right.
And he uncovered a lot of it. He built his reputation. It really made the man. And FDR picked him to get on the ticket in 1944, and within a few months he was president of the United States at a very critical time.
Right.
So oversight matters. As important as it is for members to be bold on oversight, I think it's also important for staff to be bold.
Sure.
The most dramatic example I can think of is Ambassador Peter Galbraith, who was once a staffer on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in 1987-88. He snuck over the border of Iraq into the Kurdish region and delivered evidence back to the United States of Saddam Hussein's gassing of the Kurdish population. And this was a critical human rights violation, one that often gets ignored in everything that's happened in Iraq since then. And it was important that the world know about it. This was a signal service that this staffer did and that the Congress did by giving him a forum to present that information. So, you know, oversight matters. And this is all tough, unsexy stuff, but I hope that the next Congress really invests in that stuff.
Jason Bruder, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This has been What's Next from American Security Project. I'm Maggie Feldman-Filch.